Sincerely and truthfully declare and affirm that the evidence you are about to give for this court shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
I do. Good afternoon, Mr. Smith. Would you please confirm for the court your full name is Hamish Allen Smith?
Yes.
And you've prepared two statements of evidence for these proceedings dated 26 May and 22 June 2023?
Correct.
And the first of those sets out your qualifications and experience.
Yes.
And you've assisted with preparation of some, I'll call them updates because they're not really corrections to your evidence, and rebuttal, but those were provided to the court on Sunday night, Monday morning. Can you confirm those are adjustments you'd like to make?
Yes, so the two matters it covers. The first relates to some amendments from the Natural Built Environment Act to Part 9A of the RMA, and that's covered in paragraphs 32 in the first row of Appendix 1 of my evidence in chief and paragraph 21 of my supplementary evidence. The other matter is to correct the statement from paragraph 30 of my supplementary evidence that was carried over from my evidence in chief.
Thank you. And with those corrections, do you confirm your evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yes.
Thank you. Would you please remain and answer any questions?
No question, John.
Thank you. Mr. Ryan and Ms. Boudar for the River Authority? No?
No questions, thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ryan. Mr. Minhut.
Thank you, Your Honour. Good afternoon, Mr. Smith. I've just got a few questions for you on one topic, which relates to certification of farm environment plans. Could I take you to paragraph 15.3 of your evidence in chief? And in that paragraph, you explain the benefit of certification, essentially, in significantly reducing the direct regulatory burden on councils.
Okay.
Do you consider that certification would be an important element from a compliance and monitoring perspective, therefore?
Could you please clarify?
Certainly. As far as the council's obligations in terms of monitoring compliance and enforcing, if required, the provisions of PC1, that certification would assist them would be a significant assistance to the council.
It could be. For all just questions about compliance and compliance activities of council, may be better directed to Mr. Sinclair in his evidence to follow.
Certainly. In terms of certification, though, that would provide comfort in to council as far as a more robust development process for FEPs with clear and consistent risk identification and identification of appropriate actions to address those risks. And therefore, do you consider that certification of FEPs is a critical aspect of Plan Change 1?
It is.
And that's reflected in the provisions in both Schedules D1 and D2, isn't it?
It is in D2, and for farm plans prepared in accordance with Schedule D1, I believe it is in the Rule 3.11.4.3.
Yes. And that is also consistent with the requirements under the new farm plan regulations, isn't it, as far as the detail around certification of farm environment plans?
Broadly, the system of the regulations require a farm plan to have been certified in order for the auditor to assess adherence to those actions in the certified bushwood farm plan.
Yes. And given the, I guess we have been in an environment of dynamic policy and legislative change, including in the freshwater space. Given that certification is an important component of Plan Change 1, what would happen to Plan Change 1 if there were a change to the regulations that softened or removed the requirement for certification?
Could undermine the success of Plan Change 1 in terms of achieving those water quality outcomes, in my belief.
And so, irrespective of any regulatory change?
I'll just qualify for those Schedule D2 farm plans.
Thank you. And so, your view then is that irrespective of what the certification requirements might be in the regulations at any point in time in the future, that certification, at least in your view, in terms of Schedule D2, is a critical part of Plan Change 1? Correct. Thank you. No further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Mahinick. Lancourt and Lockheel not present.
No questions, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. Wairaki Pastoral, Ms. Carruthers.
Yes, thank you, Your Honour, and good afternoon, Mrs. Smith.
Good afternoon.
I'd like to start by checking that you're the same Hamish Smith that's the signatory to the joint witness statement of the 24th of August last year in relation to alternatives.
Yes.
Yep. Right. And so you attended that initial conferencing last year, didn't you?
My signature also includes the qualification that I was not attending as a farm systems expert.
Right. And so is that why, with that qualification, is that why your evidence doesn't address overseer or the alternatives?
Correct.
Because that's outside your expertise, right? And same with the gateways and thresholds and the rules.
In terms of overseer, correct.
Right. Now, I noticed that you haven't prepared any rebuttal evidence, so I wanted to check if you had read Mr. Ford's evidence and his explanation of that conferencing session.
No, I haven't. I haven't read his evidence.
Okay. Did you only read a confined set of the evidence to the council before preparing your rebuttal?
I may have read. I read through the evidence that I was provided, and from the evidence I was provided, I couldn't see any points of rebuttal required for myself. I don't recall reading Mr. Ford's evidence, but it may have been in that list that I was given. Assume it was.
Okay. So your focus of your evidence is the implications of parallel implementation of two farm plan regimes. Have I understood that correctly?
Correct.
And it seems quite clear that your preference is for one farm plan per property.
One farm planning system, insofar as that means one farm plan for the property, then yes.
Right. And it seems fairly clear from your evidence that your concern is the that the differences between the two regimes pose significant risk to implementation.
Correct.
And your advice is to change Plan Change 1 to coexist with the regulations.
Correct. That's a summary, summarisation. Yep.
And so I anticipate you're aware that Plan Change 1, the version before the court, has been amended to remove the overlap with the intensive winter grazing regulations that we now have in the NES freshwater.
I understand that.
Are you aware of those changes have been made?
I'm aware of those changes.
No. Okay. So then if we turn to your supplementary evidence, which is where you've provided very helpful comments on the newer regulations, the freshwater farm plan regulations, your conclusion is that there's still significant misalignment between the regulations and PC1.
Correct.
And as I read your evidence, you seem to prefer the regulations. You find them more detailed, more extensive, more thorough.
In relation to the process and the roles in that system, yes.
And so, at both paragraphs 30 and at 45, you talk about part D, if retained. Well, there's a suggestion in both those paragraphs about the plan change one FEPs potentially being retained. If I read that correctly?
Correct.
And so there's an option, like with the intensive winter grazing provisions, that these farm plan provisions could be removed from plan change one. Is that what you're suggesting there when you say if retained?
Certainly an option. The what I'm trying to get at here is to explain that the regulations and PC1 come at this problem from two different ends. The regulations start at a risk assessment process. PC1 starts at a these are the outcomes that we're trying to achieve. And insofar as those two situations can potentially coexist, that's what I'm suggesting here. If they were retained, I think they could coexist.
And so when you've used the phrase if retained in your evidence, is that, well, why have you used that to suggest it may not be retained?
I think it's as simple as it's read as if retained. I understand that Mr. Trebelco has, in his evidence, made the decision to retain it in his supplementary evidence.
Okay. So if they were not to be retained, then it's important to first check if there would be any gaps in that scenario. And I understand that's what you've attempted to do in your paragraph 25.
Of which evidence?
Particularly the final, of your supplementary. The final sentence of your paragraph 25. I had read that as you identifying situations that may not require a farm plan under the regs, but may require one under the Plan Change 1 provisions.
Correct. And vice versa.
Sorry, what do you mean by and vice versa?
In terms of the potential for some farms to require a farm plan under PC1, but not the regs, and similarly the other way around.
Ah, I see. Okay, so that makes sense then. So the ones that are under 20 hectares, those are the farms that the regs don't need a farm plan, but PC1 does. And similarly, PC1 requires, if you've got more than 5% arable cropping, to have a farm plan.
As an example, the triggers for needing a farm plan, PC1, are a bit more nuanced than Part 9A. And in some cases, they don't really, the definitions in each of the instruments don't align, and so some activities may or may not, just by that very nature of the differences in those triggers.
Right. And so to the extent that you've been able to analyse it so far, is it just the farms under 20 hectares that PC1 would pick up that wouldn't have been picked up under the regulations?
Regulations might, like I said, converse regulations might pick up activities that don't require a farm plan under PC1, for example, horticultural activities that aren't commercial vegetable, it's not commercial vegetable production. But yes, there's in terms of PC1 has the potential to pick up more farms, put it that way. In terms of the triggers, they're more nuanced, and so for those farms under 20 hectares, there are more trips, I guess, in terms of being tripped up by the requirements and needing to have a farm plan.
Yes, for the farms under 20 hectares. And just for a sense of scale, have you any idea how many farms are under 20 hectares in the catchments of PC1?
I couldn't give you an accurate figure. I have seen some estimates, but I believe I believe Brent Mr. Sinclair's evidence highlights the number of farms potentially over 20 hectares, and that's about 5,000 farms. Under 20 hectares, I wouldn't be sure how many, but it could be equally as much, as many, if not more.
I might ask Mr. Sinclair that then. So with the regulations that have recently come out and are in some parts of the Waikato already in force and in other parts soon to be, do you agree that on farm we will soon be making progress regardless of PC1?
Yes, in the sense that farmers will have a farm plan potentially before PC1 and put in place actions on farm before if they aren't already, of course. So there is a potential for that to be the case. The extent to which that will achieve, I'll leave it there.
And so in terms of Commissioner Hodges' questions or comments either yesterday or the day before about not going backwards, there's no risk of that now with these regulations in place, is there? Even without PC1.
I wouldn't want to make, that's probably
wide-ranging.
Better directed at Mr. Trebelko, as to whether...
Sure. That's fine. And so it's a little unclear from your evidence and also from the way you carefully phrased your answer before whether your preference would be to retain the farm plan provisions in Plan Change 1 as well or to remove them.
My evidence doesn't express a preference, certainly. Simply says this could work this way, it could work a different way. And I've left it to Mr. Trebelko through his evidence to make the decision on what the most appropriate response moving forward is, and he's chosen to maintain Part D of both schedules.
Thank you. That's very helpful. I've got no further questions, Your Honour. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Carruthers.
Thank you, Your Honour. Good afternoon, Mr. Smith. I'm representing Fish and Game. Thank you. So, in the freshwater farm plan regulations, I heard you say that you think that starts more at a risk assessment rather than the outcomes you're trying to achieve. And the regulations at Regulation 9 refers to these catchment context challenges and values.
Correct.
And it states, if information relating to the catchment context challenges and values is available from the relevant regional council, the farm operator must have regard to the following: when identifying and assessing the risks and actions, first the CV for the local area, and secondly the impacts that the farmer has on the receiving environment.
Great.
And then in the PC1, this CCCV is supplemented somewhat by method 311.36. And you're nodding, so you're familiar with that.
Yes.
And that states that in addition to what information is required in the freshwater farm plan regulations, to support the preparation and review of farm environment plan, also include interim target states, current attribute states, the reduction required, and the contaminants of most concern in each subcatcher.
Correct.
So, Fish and Game's concerned with making sure that that information is available for particularly subcatchments of most concern in relation to the receiving environment. And you've also set out in your evidence what the tranches in PC1 are for the various subcatchments, and that is at
paragraph 18 of my supplementary reference.
Yep, thank you. Paragraph 18. Yes, that's very convenient. In relation to the subcatchments, though, the Whangamurino wetland and various lakes have been put into year one.
Say that again, sorry, I didn't catch that. So the Whangamurino, Whangamurino is in the lower Waikato, and that 18-month period to submit a freshwater farm plan to a certifier, that window of opportunity starts from 1 July 2024.
Is this under the regulations?
Yes.
Okay, I understand there's a slight mismatch between the priorities and the regulations and the priorities in the land change. And I found the reference, it's table 311.2, if you could turn to that in the post-conferencing version of the land change.
I have a copy of the legal submission version, is that okay?
That's it, and it's at page 69. So there it has in the left-hand column, it has the year.
Yes.
And that's the year from the date plan change one is made operative, isn't it?
Yes.
And then it has the subcatchments identified. And we've got year one from the date comes operative, 2 years from the date comes operative, 2 years, 9 months, etc.
Yep.
And the Whangamurino is year one.
Yes.
And I don't know if you're aware, but some lake catchments have been elevated to year two, and that's shown in the blue lining there, the certain lake catchments.
Yeah.
So, so say PC1 is made operative in mid-2024. The year one subcatchments, including the Whangamurino, would need to have the FEPs provided by mid-2025, because that's 1 year. Yes?
Yes.
And should the... Are you familiar with the plan change process for the 2024 plan change?
No, sorry.
All right, I'll leave that there then, and I'll ask another witness about the implications of that issue. Thank you. Thank you. I know we have no questions.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Fuchs,
no questions.
Not here again. Mr. Pennell, are you on the line?
I am, sir, and I have some questions for Mr. Smith. Thank you.
Away you go.
Mr. Smith, my concern, I hope, around duplication of the regulations and the various consents. required for various activities, and there's a particular focus on the control of activity consent for farming. excuse me. First question, both taking the regs and PC1 together, do you see that both the certifier and the consent officer are both decision makers in the process?
As far as I would understand a decision maker in terms of an RMA decision maker as a council officer might be in processing the consent, no. So they are making an assessment as to whether the farm plan is fit for purpose. That farm plan for PC1, if it's associated with a consent, would then go with the application to be considered by a decision maker, be that a council officer, be that through a hearing process, commissioner, or ultimately in court, potentially.
Okay, in the first instance, doesn't the reg require the certifier to approve? So then under a consent of activity, then it goes to council for approval.
Yes, so the certifier in their technical capacity is certifying the farm plan as for the purpose, and then yes, it would go to council if it's associated with a consent application to be considered through that process.
Is there room for duplication? How do you propose to manage the avoidance of duplication?
But could you please clarify in terms of the two processes?
Yes, between the consent officer and the certifier, and my interpretation, and I could well be wrong, making decisions over essentially the same matters.
So if you, in terms of questions about the decision-making process of council and council officers, that's a question probably better aimed at Mr. Sinclair. The role, as I understand it, of the council office, of the consent process may include requiring additional actions in the farm plan and the resource consent to achieve the outcomes that PC1 is seeking.
Okay, well, I think you've suggested I take up the matter with Mr. Sinclair, so I'll do such, and that's the end of my questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pennell. No one else? No? Any re-examination?
I think so. Just one question, really, Mr. Smith. Good afternoon. I'm just keen to try and ensure that the requirements for the farm environment plans are clear and easy to understand for everybody. And you mentioned that the regulations and the PC1 requirements come from different areas. Would you see any advantage in something like an additional goal at the start of PC1 provisions, talking about the risk assessment, to get some kind of better alignment than what there is now? I'm not looking for any major reviews or anything like that, but if you can have a consistency of requirement of the both documents to start off with, it may help people to understand. Do you have a view on that?
Good to. I guess the approach that has been put forward by is to essentially lean on the regulations to do much of that process, and then bolt on what PC1 is expecting as outcomes and additional requirements. With a goal at the start of the schedule, which outlined that, it might be beneficial. I don't have any strong views on that.
I'm really thinking of the user of this document and having everything in one place within reason. That's all I'm thinking of. But you
you're relatively neutral on that and indeed Mr. Trevisan.
Yeah. Great.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I have no questions. Anything you're asking one of the Commission's questions? Thank you very much for your evidence, Mr. Superintendent.
Next witness is Mr. St. Clair.
About to give to this court shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Good afternoon, Mr. Sinclair. Could you please confirm for the court your full name is James Brent Foxton Sinclair?
It is.
And you prepared two statements of evidence in these proceedings, dated 26 May and 25 August 2023?
Right.
And the first of those sets out your qualifications and experience.
It does.
And do you have any corrections to make to your evidence?
I do not.
Thank you. Do you then confirm it's true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
It is.
Thank you. Would you please remain and answer any questions?
No questions, Your Honour.
Thank you. Mr. Ryan, for the River Authority.
No questions. No questions. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honour. Good afternoon, Mr. Sinclair.
Good afternoon.
Just a few questions along similar lines to the questions of the previous witness. Could I take you to paragraph 63 of your evidence in chief, please?
Yes.
And particularly the last sentence of that paragraph. You talk about essentially the significance of FEPs as a delivery mechanism for PC1.
Correct.
And you then refer to the council's general expectation that where a farm environment plan is certified that it will be PC1 compliant.
Correct.
So therefore, from a broader compliance and monitoring perspective, would you consider certification of farm plans to be important in terms of PC1?
Correct. I've had a bit of a think about that hearing you ask the question of Hamish, and I think it would be helpful to contextualise the system. Bearing in mind, one of my comments is about having a system that is... has the minimum level of intervention that is reasonable in circumstances, because I think, as we've all appreciated, there's significant cost that comes with intervention, whether that intervention is by the council or by certifier or otherwise. So we need to make sure that it's right. And so clearly the rule framework has a very permissive end, moving up to a very restrictive end, and there's grayscale in the middle of that. And so clearly in the... rule 311.43, it's called more restrictive of the permissive rules than the medium level rule. It's a standards based. And originally, I see that there wasn't a certification for that standards based, but an expectation that those standards are achieved, and then an auditing afterwards to confirm that those standards are being achieved. In my view, a very important part of the process, because that enables a trusted advisor, if I call it that way, a trusted advisor to go onto a farming property or the farmer to be able to identify that those actions are being achieved. And then, of course, we have the more bespoke farm plan based on objectives where the certifier is going to be upfront and then the auditor afterwards. I think we're being somewhat overtaken by the Freshwater Farm Plan regulations, which require the certification of, upfront of all of those, which does provide an added level of... upfront conversation with the farmer around that the
which would ensure understanding of the standards. And from a compliance perspective, it's a long way to get to your answer. From a compliance perspective, the better the regulated party understands, the higher the level of compliance. So therefore, it only aids to eventual compliance.
Thank you. And you've mentioned auditing as well. I'll come back to that shortly. In terms of the question of certification, just rounding that out, the you heard my questions of Mr. Smith in terms of the role of certification, particularly in the context of Schedule D2. And if, as currently drafted, PC1 is directs parties to the requirements of the regulations as far as certification requirements, doesn't it?
Yes, yes.
And so if there were to be a change in those regulations that softened or removed the requirement for certification, there would then be a risk to PC1 and its outcomes?
Yes. In short, yes. So the question becomes what would be the avenues to address that issue, should that risk arise, and whether one there's risks across the board of things changing in the future, and the question becomes how much crystal ball gazing does one do around potential risks, and therefore what does one do to try to create a situation where that risk may not be able to materialise, as opposed to the mechanism for addressing that risk may be, let's say, less onerous than putting in place an avoidance of the risk in the first place.
Certainly, and are you aware of the approach on that particular issue that Fonterra and Dairy NZ have proposed in their provisions?
Essentially locking in the regs as gazetted. Yeah.
Yes. And would you agree that that would avoid that risk of regulatory change addressing this aspect of the overall PC1 package, which you consider to be important?
The short answer is yes, but I'll give a slightly longer answer. It can create implementation challenges for those of you that are implementation folk. The more instruments that your staff have to understand, the more instruments that your regulated party has to understand, becomes a greater challenge for the success of that implementation. So the scenario that you've described could result in there being a form of the regs that is valid in the Waikato Waipara region, which is different than the form of the regs that's applicable in the Hauraki region, which in itself isn't helpful for the regulated parties who often have properties in both catchments, or for the regulator. So I guess I've been quite careful in my evidence to say I'm not here to talk about merits. Once upon a time, I might have given evidence to the court about merits, but that's not my role anymore. I have an overarching role in the council, not a specific role, so I don't want to muddy the waters by getting into merits. But there are challenges for implementation. The more instruments that you have to communicate with the farmer and communicate with your staff. And so I'd really be keen for the parties to see what is the risk that that's going to be there, given that if government were to look to change the regulations, there's a process that needs to go through. The government's still obliged to give effect to 25 minute, which across the board is the overarching policy document that it must be given effect to in the Waikato and Waikau regions, rivers. So one looks at what's the risk that might occur, given that the government is obliged to give effect to 25 minute, and it's hard to see how they could remove something which is an integral element of Plan Change 1, which is being promoted by the Regional Council and its EB partners, to realise the risk that you've described. But I accept your commentary that there is at risk. The question becomes, how does one manage that risk? I hope that's been helpful.
Thank you. In your answer, you referred to the additional complexity generated by having to look at different frameworks or different sets of regulations and the like. On that, and Mr. Smith talked to that previously, as far as this challenge of bringing together PC1 with the critical farm plan regulations. As far as duplication, there's two levels to that duplication, though, isn't there? One is on farm as far as what a farmer might need to do in avoiding duplication by the farmer as far as his or her obligations. But there's also the question of the drafting the PC1 and the duplication of wording within the document itself, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. So we often talk outside of this room that flattery is the greatest form of acknowledging the farm planning processes can put forward this one, because the freshwater farm planning regs have attempted to do something similar, but as Mr. Smith's identified, not quite the same. And as implementers, we know there's devils in the detail. And so what we're particularly concerned about is process. There seems to be a lot of similarities. Putting aside the subtleties of the words, identifying risks, identifying actions to achieve good outcomes, both have similar sort of objectives, but there's quite different, there's a few differences in terms of process. We've tried the best we can to influence government around process, around timing, when things need to be done, and what information is needed to be provided. And I think Mr. Tabulka and Mr. Smith have done a pretty good job, from my understanding, about trying to align these things as best they can. And I hope the court finds that it can use Section 293 to enable that, because I similarly agree that the sooner our farmers have certainty of these rules, the sooner they can get on and continue the work that many of them have started already. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Certainly. Essentially, I take it from your answers that in a perfect world, Plan Change 1 and its provisions would be the sole place that either farmers or council officers need to go to as far as looking at what the relevant requirements are.
Yes, so if I considered it a different artificial world where the regulations were in place before Plan Change 1 started, that's kind of the world that I'm hoping the process here will now follow. So what are the additional requirements? Remember that the freshwater farm plans are a national instrument. They're not bespoke to a particular region. They're a national instrument. And so what are the particular elements that Plan Change 1 should address in addition to the, let's just call it the minimums across the country of freshwater farm plan regulations to achieve the 2-5-minute? That's the challenge that the planners of the court, as I see it.
Certainly. Now, just moving on to auditing, so just so I'm clear on that, so that again is a tool that is, or it's a stage or process that you consider adds rigour to the farm environment plan process?
It does multiple things. One of the things, it adds rigour. But importantly, it allows relatively limited resources to be focused where it's best to focus them. And so I see that the national regulations, again, mirror what PC1 was trying to say, which comes back to what I said in my evidence around we need to support and encourage good practice. And so an auditing frequency which is low for those that are leading the way supports and encourages good practice. An auditing process which is more regular for those that are at the other end of the spectrum gives the incentive for people to move down to the other end of the spectrum, if that makes sense. So yes, it's an important part of the process, and I think it's appropriate to note that it can be quite challenging for some rural landowners having a regulator on their properties, and so that intermediary auditor who hopefully will be a trusted party to be able to keep people on track will aid the system as a whole.
Thank you. One final aspect. You've talked about this regulatory spectrum as far as the level of involvement, and each stage helps the council with its overall regulatory burden, but there's different levels of intervention. And you've got certification at one point, auditing. At the other end, there is reporting requirements, aren't there? As far as that is a lower level of intervention.
Oh, absolutely.
But it would also assist the council in its overall regulatory burden or obligation as far as having mandatory reporting obligations in some shape or form?
Absolutely. Just the registration system in itself is helpful. The Waikato region is a little bit different than a number of regions around the country where so much of our rural activity is being undertaken through permitted activity, which means knowledge about what's going on out there is less fulsome than it would be where you're in a region where all activity is consented. So all of that helps identify risk, identify where intervention can be best be applied to achieve those outcomes.
Certainly. And you would have heard through some of the answers given by other council witnesses about intensification and farming intensity being a critical piece of the puzzle as far as an understanding of risk in terms of activities.
Absolutely.
And so would you support a requirement for annual reporting of farming intensity, whether that be dairy, dry stock, CVP?
It's a tricky question to answer in isolation without knowing the imposition that would place on a farmer. So clearly the current intensity thresholds are around deciding whether you're in the permitted pathway or you're into the consented pathway. I suppose one would have to ask the question, what is the risk that there would be parties that post finding their way into the permissive pathway intensify to such an extent that they would otherwise need to go into a consented pathway? And is that something that warrants the burden that would be placed on all of those parties to provide the sort of reporting that you're referring to? Pretty tricky to answer that question without knowing that those two ends of the spectrum. Clearly, there will be times when information comes to light, and you may be surprised how often information comes to light that comes to our attention. And we can clearly then go to a party to confirm that they sit within the permissive category. So I can understand where you're coming from. I think it may be, but hopefully my answer makes it clear. I can see the benefits of what you're saying, but I'm not sure whether or not the costs that and the burden that gets applied onto the farming community outweighs that benefit. So maybe that's a question that you could ask Mr. Trebucca if there is some information about the cost-benefit around that.
Sure, and I guess as far as the benefits of having that information, though, there is both the question of whether an individual farmer moves activity status, so that is one benefit from a regulatory perspective of having that information, but in terms of the overall effectiveness of the Plan Change 1 framework and whether that direction of travel is heading in the right direction, wouldn't that also be information that's useful for the council from that perspective?
As I said, I can see the benefits in what you're saying. It's just, is that the best mechanism for doing it? So, for example, we have the nitrogen reporting NCAP regulations that requires information about synthetic nitrogen to be provided. There's a number of mechanisms for trying to identify whether or not there's trend and change, and what you're suggesting is one. Sitting here, I don't know what is the best way to do that. Again, I don't know if that helps your answer. I realise what you're kind of, in a sense, asking me is the suggestion that requiring them to present a report every year, is that something that I would support? I don't know that I can sit here and say that. I don't know that I have the information in front of me to say that I support it, but I understand the concept.
Thank you. No further questions.
Mr. Minhag. Yes.
Good afternoon. I'm representing Federated Farmers and Beef and Lamb New Zealand. I've got one question, and tell me if you think this is better directed to somebody else, but it comes out of your answer before, which was a need to be alert to the potential imposition costs which you fairly acknowledge. And you would agree that out of everything that's going on in farmers' lives at the moment, we should be quite conscious of any unnecessary additional imposition. Do you agree?
Absolutely.
In Schedule B of the plan, of the PC1, sets out certain information that needs to be provided. If you've got a copy, it's a very simple question, so you may not need to go to it, but it's page 37, 38 of the version that you might have.
Yes.
Under AB or under records to be there's a reference here. The following records must be kept, retained for the life of the plan.
Number five.
That's right. So number five, and down there it's got records of stock numbers, stock classes, weight, births, deaths, replacement rates. My clients are asking that the reference to weights be deleted on the basis that it doesn't seem to provide any useful information for anybody, and the cost of and hassle of doing that would seem to outweigh any benefit to be gained. And again, tell me if you'd rather I direct this to somebody else, but are you aware of any benefit that would be gained from providing that information?
Best to direct that elsewhere, but I understand that there is one of the rules that refers to weight of animals on a property, and so I imagine that requirement to provide weights relates to the ability to assess compliance with that. I think there's a rule about not having animals above 400 kgs or something like that. Bear with me, you know, my role is not to be...
No, I did preface my question with...
But I presume the writer of the rule has a purpose for seeking information about weights, and I'm presuming it relates to understanding the compliance with other elements of the rule.
Right. Yeah. But if there was no other requirement in any rule to manage an animal based on weight, you as far as you know, you'd see no benefit for it.
So... I'll answer it as an old consent processor. You ask for the information that's going to help you manage the matter that you're trying to manage, and so for that, I'll ask that question to Mr. DeLuca about the issue that's obviously managed by seeking that information.
Thank you.
Ms. Carruthers.
Thanks, Your Honour. Just a few questions, if I may. Mr. Sinclair, if we could please turn to paragraph 53 of your evidence in chief. In the second sentence where you say, I also understand there is concern amongst a number of appellant parties about the use of overseer in PC1.
Yes.
Are you aware that it's the regional council who has expressed the concern about the use of overseer in Plan Change 1?
Are you saying that it's only the regional council that's concerned and none of the appellants are concerned?
That's right. It's the regional council that's proposing to remove it.
That's a different question. My question to you, I shouldn't ask you questions, but are you saying that none of the appellants are concerned? I know it's the regional council that have proposed the changes because the regional council is clearly concerned, but are you saying that none of the appellants are concerned?
My understanding is that none of the appellants are seeking through this process to remove the use of overseer in Plan Change 1, and it's the regional council's proposal. Is that not your understanding?
So, clearly, the regional council is the party that has proposed changes here. My understanding was that appellant parties were also concerned about overseer. If I am wrong, then my apologies. But I understood that there was more broad concern around the use of overseer, and hence one of the, hence the reason for the proposed change.
And is that an understanding you've gleaned through discussions with appellants or what internally at council?
Well, I haven't had any conversations with appellants. So this is my understanding from my colleagues, that there is concerns about the use of overseer.
Okay. And so turning then to the two problems that you perceive with overseer, which you've helpfully set out on the page. The first being the inherent limitations with overseer, that's been acknowledged for years, is it not? That's not a new issue.
I'm not an overseer expert, so my understanding is that those are the inherent challenges with overseer held. I'm not an overseer expert, I'm just identifying that that's my understanding, that there are inherent problems, and when those problems become apparent is not something that I personally are aware of.
And so are you aware that those issues with overseer were specifically considered by the panel who considered Plan Change 1 at the council level, or that's beyond your knowledge?
Beyond my knowledge, but I presume that they heard evidence around these overseer.
Right. And then in terms of the burgeoning problem, which you set out at B, my understanding is that a number of the appeals to this court seek to resolve or rectify that particular problem, and I understand that council has work streams in other catchments to do the same with its existing use of overseer. Is that correct?
You might have to unpick that one. I think you might ask two questions there. Can you unpick it for one at a time?
Sorry, yes I can. So if we call this the versioning problem in B.
Yes.
Were you aware that appeals to Plan Change 1 seek to address that particular concern with overseer?
No, I haven't put my mind, I haven't put my the purpose of my evidence is around implementation efficiency. I haven't put my mind to matters as it relates to overseer. Where my evidence relates to overseer was premised is that if it creates implementation difficulties, then a more simple system that doesn't create implementation difficulties would be preferable. If evidence is presented to the court and the court favours the use of overseer, then as I note in paragraph 54, we will implement what we are delivered. From an implementation perspective, my understanding was that it was going to be more challenging because of the, remember these are threshold gates, and threshold gates need to be something which is simple for the party and simply for the regulator to operationalise, and where you have something which is that complicated a gate thresholding mechanism, which was what my understanding of the concerns were. My evidence from an implementation perspective is, can we have something which creates simplicity for the regulated party and the regulator when you're looking at gateways? That's as far as I was looking to go with my evidence, not get into any of the merits or anything else. Yeah.
And so where you finish then in 54 by saying that you support simpler methodologies, that's effectively a plea to make it fairly straightforward to work out which category you're in and what you need to do.
Absolutely. There's nothing more frustrating than for a regulated party or a regulator for it to be confusing about what activity status you are. It should be easy. If there's an enormous amount of effort that has to go into just determining activity status, then I would be supportive of a simpler method. If the overseer system is the most simple method that there is, then we will implement it.
Right, thank you. So I'd like to then turn to Rule 3.11.4.9, non-compliant rules, which you discussed at your paragraph 3.7. Now, I will put most of my questions in relation to this rule to Mr. Trebalco. But may I just check before I ask my questions in relation to your paragraph 47, what it is you understand Rule 3.11.4.9 to be authorised?
I'll paraphrase my understanding of it, because I truly appreciate I don't process consents anymore, I haven't done for a long time. So my paraphrasing is, this is the hold the line rule, which effectively says to, if your footprint is increasing, if I could use that language, you are not complying. Which is, if you link it back to my comment in 47, that creates a clearer process early on for the regulated party, which says if you can't demonstrate that your footprint is no greater, this is going to be a difficult road to hoe. So effectively, that is a hold the line rule.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll come on to how an application is considered, but if we could just skip ahead for a moment. If somebody managed to obtain a consent under 3.11.4.9, what is your understanding of what that would be authorising?
At the risk of being dangerous, and I say that, I'm always conscious when you get to a position in an organisation, your little bit of knowledge can become dangerous, and therefore not helpful. It's probably better to pose that question to Mr. Trebalco, because, as I explained before, I'm not actively practicing consenting on a daily basis, so it's probably better to ask those detailed type questions to Mr. Trebalco.
Okay, and so your comment then in 47 is a very general statement about non-complying activities.
Yes, it's. I think for a regulated party, if the direction of the plan is to hold the line in relation to those increasing footprints, it then means that a party doesn't go down through a very, very long process to end up in potentially a costly process when early on you can identify this is something where you're, let's say, you're paddling against the current. And that's what I'm trying to express in 47. It gives an opportunity very early on to say this is not something that the plan anticipates. But it isn't prohibited, it's just something that the plan doesn't anticipate.
Right. And sorry, I might not need to unpick this because you have been clear that you're no longer a consent planner. But if I could just check, is it your understanding that the decision as to whether something passes through the gateway is made much earlier in time than the Section 104 assessment.
Well, so there's different points in time when that decision gets made. The very first point of time when that decision gets made is when an applicant might take professional advice from their own lawyer and their own planner. And their own lawyer or planner very early on will look and go, I don't know if this is the path that you want to proceed down. And so in that regard, it gives really upfront advice for an applicant when they are taking advice about whether or not this is something that is likely to be successful.
I see. And so that's all you're meaning to say in your paragraph 47?
Yes, I think if you have a different view about what the purpose of non-compliant activities is, by all means share, but that's my understanding, is that's what it's about trying to do, try to create an efficient process of what activities are not in the general direction of the plan.
Okay. I will take my other questions to Mr. Trebarco on that, but it's very helpful. Just one final question, in light of the fact that, as I understand it, you're in charge of the enforcement team at council, is that correct?
Yes.
Probably not in charge. Sorry, that might have been a bit loose language.
So, yeah, I prefer to describe it as compliance monitoring enforcement, because compliance is a full spectrum, and that includes promotion, education, support, incentives, all the way through to enforcement, as you appreciate, but it's a full spectrum approach. So I am in charge of the enforcement end as well as the totality of those compliance functions, yeah.
Okay. Are you able to advise whether the council has taken any enforcement action within that full realm for breaches of Rule 3.11.4.9 since it was notified?
To the best of my knowledge, no. I think it would be fair to say that we only know what we know. So that doesn't mean that there haven't been parties out there that have undertaken land use change. But to the best of my knowledge, but again, I don't get involved with day-to-day lower-level compliance activities. As you'll appreciate, the things that level to myself are things that might end up before a judge, as opposed to day-to-day minor exceedances, things that happen and then are undone. Those low-level non-compliances happen on a daily basis, as you'll appreciate. But I don't believe that we've taken any cases that may come before the court in relation to that rule.
Okay, thank you. I've got no further questions, Your Honour. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Brothers. Ms. Hongman.
Thank you, Your Honour. Good afternoon, Mr. St.
Clair.
Just picking up from what Ms. Brothers was discussing in relation to the Rock Gateway, I wish to take you to your paragraph 51. And there you've set out a list of criteria for a gateway in the ideal world, at least from an implementation perspective.
Yes.
And then in paragraph 52, you also state that gateways should also be technically sound and justifiable in resource management terms. And I think I heard you say to Ms. Carruthers that you're not giving evidence on that particular issue, just on the implementation issue.
Correct.
So, in terms of implementation, going back to paragraph 51, I understand A, clear as to its meaning, e.g. avoiding subjective terminology. B, objective, not subjective. If I can just add a comment to those two. What if you had two tolls and you could choose between each toll? Would you support that?
We would make it work if we had to, but as I mentioned before, both for the regulated party and the regulator, if you have to learn and understand how two systems work, there's just more effort, more time, more cost that comes with training one's staff, preparing advice to, whilst I'm sure people in this room and their clients will do the best they can to inform their the farmers that they are representing, inevitably it falls to my staff because they come to my staff for advice. And so where it's nice and clear and simple that my staff can provide that advice, the more complicated it is, the more difficult that is. So I think it's a long way of saying we can deal with two, but one would be better.
Thank you, that's clear. Subparagraph C, you say readily determinable, i.e. not requiring complex or potentially unavailable information or experts, unquote. In terms of complexity, I understand the issue about information requirements, but the toll itself could have complexity within it, couldn't it?
Yes, obviously as a toll has complexity in it, and with complexity comes often expertise that's needed to unravel that complexity. Both from the regulated party's perspective, but also the regulator's perspective. So what I've tried to say in 52 is, and it's kind of been my plea through this to enable it to be implementable both the regulated party and the regulator, it's not all about me and my people. We recognise that there's more to it. But what we do recognise at times is that the implementability issues sometimes get overlooked when things are put in place. And so we just wanted to make sure that it's very clearly on the table, both for the regulator party and the regulator, to not overlook those matters when looking at the totality of how a system's going to work. In particular, picking up on the comments that have come through from the court and commissioners that we need to ensure that our regulated parties engage. Nothing works if they don't engage. And so we have to have a system that they will engage with. And the more complex you make a system, the more difficult it becomes to get engagement, and then puts at risk the outcomes that the process is trying to achieve. And in particular, again, excuse me as I might sit on a soapbox for a minute, that this is an 80-year process. We're looking to get people engaged, to maintain that engagement and to have continual stepped improvement over time. I know I'm stepping outside my evidence now, tell me off if I am. Anything which creates a complexity that doesn't encourage engagement puts at risk the successful achievement of outcomes.
Yes, thank you. I understand where you're coming from an implementation perspective. But you would acknowledge, wouldn't you, that there is a trade-off between that aspect and whether the tools actually fit for the purpose stated on the objectives and policies of the plan?
Oh, absolutely. I 100% agree with you that it's not all about the ease of implementation. It's just a factor to be put into the overall mix around achieving the outcomes that Te Tiri Whaimana is demanding of us.
Yes, and so the inputs for a tool and the ease of its use, that would ideally be readily determinable and understandable by a farmer. But to what extent does, and we've talked about algorithms and some things like that, to what extent do you think that a farmer needs to understand modelling and algorithms in order to achieve buy-in?
I agree with that. So the farmer needs to know the information that they need to gather, the auditable information that they need to gather, the auditable information that they need to provide. If it costs them $2,000 to go to then have somebody do a whole bunch of work to decide what activity status they are, it's something that I think parties should consider if that is adding the value that we're looking to achieve as part of engagement of the process as a whole.
I'm not so much asking about cost. I'm asking about does a farmer or consent applicant necessarily need to understand the internal workings of a particular topic? Well,
no, they need to know the information that they need to provide. Yeah.
Now a good time to take a break? We'll be going for a little bit more.
5 more minutes.
Very good. We'll take a break now.